This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, so right off the bat, before we even introduce everyone, Jason Phelps, we're going to create a scenario. Okay?
Okay.
And you're going to respond to the scenario like how you would suggest people to respond to the scenario.
All right.
Now, who can do like a pretty convincing gobble noise? Oh. Mark, please.
Yeah.
Mark Kenyon?
Yeah. Do you want me to sample it for you? Or?
Yeah, let me hit it.
Yeah, okay. Let me get my goblin.
Okay, so yeah, you guys, intense. You know how when you get a couple gobblers gobbling over each other,
right?
All right, and then who can be an angry hen?
I'll go angry hen. What's an angry
hen?
Well,
no, you're gonna be a gobbler. You're the boss gobbler. Okay. Mark's the
you're already the subordinate. Putting me lower in the pecking order. We haven't even got to duke it out yet.
Okay. Mark's the boss gobbler, and Remy's like the gobbler that always tries to gobble over the boss gobbler.
Okay.
And we need a angry hen. Brody?
No, I can't do it by mouth. I don't
have Can anyone to. Do an angry hen? Who's doing that? Oh, with no aid of Yeah, but I want her like angry. Okay. So, okay. So here you are. Now I'm gonna paint the scenario for you.
All right.
Okay. It's Jason Phelps. Phelps game calls. You've been making a lot of calls?
I have.
Just like, are dudes buying turkey calls right now, or did they already buy them?
They are still right up to the last day, right up to the last week buying.
There's still guys that are like, now that it's opening day tomorrow, I'm gonna get a turkey call.
The typical response is, hey, if I order today, can you get them out tomorrow, and will they be to me by the next day?
Can you have them to my campground? Yeah. Can you have them to my campsite?
Yeah. No, it's.
Okay, so here you are. It's dark, okay? And you're 150 yards away, and here's what's happening.
All right,
okay? So that's what's going on.
Okay, so we're going to do real soft tree ups if they're still on the tree.
So you're calculating. They're up in the roost.
Yeah.
And you're going to – this is how you're going to do it.
And then I'll pause. It's not going to be a lot. You know, drag those out.
Well, these gobblers are low T because normal gobblers would have been all over that.
Yeah. My calling's that bad that they won't even respond out of the roost to my tree yelp.
So that's your tree yelp.
Really quiet, 4 to 5 yelps.
And what are you thinking when you think in the tree yelp?
I'm just letting them know. Ideally, I'm still on the tree as a hen. You know, they're pretty good at pinpointing, but I'm trying to let them know there is a, you know, a hen over in that tree.
When you say tree yelp, you're saying that not that you're yelping to them in the tree, but you're in your tree
I'm
too.
I'm still in my tree. I haven't flown down yet. So I'm trying to paint that picture. They usually roost next to some other hens. They know is a for sure thing, but I want to let them know, hey, there's another hen that's over here.
Okay, hit me with the tree yelp again. Yeah.
And so by their instant response, I know they just heard that. And so I may not get really aggressive. I might. That's enough. Just to acknowledge that.
Because I'm getting to a point in my life where I feel like if I was better at math, I would figure if you made no noise at all, what are the odds, knowing that it's a 360-degree circle around the gobbler's tree, what are the odds that he's just going to walk past you anyway? And it changes the farther out you get, I feel.
Yep.
But it would be a good math question because I feel like I feel like as much as you think you're going to call gobblers off the roost, it probably works about as many times as what the odds are that he's going to walk through your 5-degree band.
Yep. I'm going to say I'm pretty good at turkey off the roost math, and it's usually 0 times like 472 tries, so 0%. That thing, no matter what, I've never still to this day killed a turkey off the roost.
Yeah, I've been there when it's happened, but then I feel like, well, yeah, eventually it makes sense that he'll leave the roost, and when he has, and he'll pick the spoke of the wheel that I happen to be sitting on.
Yep, and that's the time is it.
But now, so who's the angry hen?
Oh, sorry, that's a gobbler.
Yeah, well, okay, so now let me hit you with this scenario now, and then I'm going to hit you with another scenario.
Okay.
So here's this scenario. You're angry henning it?
I can do that too, I guess.
Okay, so Remy, hit your gobble. Hit your tree yelp. And Mark, hit your angry hen. Okay, now what are you thinking? Has your thought changed?
So did he gobble before? He gobbled before I did my tree yelp, so he never acknowledged me yet. I may tree yelp again and see if I can get him to spark off on that yelp.
Let's try it.
I just want him to, all right. And then I'll probably be quiet. I want him to call.
Even though the angry hen is now angry.
They're typically fairly quiet in the tree, so you don't want to like overdo it while you're still in the tree and it's too dark to pitch down. So you're just trying to, he's acknowledged me now, and then I'm going to be quiet until they do heat up right before they fly down, so we may get back in the game at that point.
Yeah, because then they hit the ground, and so often never make a peep.
Yep, yep. They made eye contact. They know what they're after. They don't need to communicate at that point, and so yeah, they seem to kind of, they get pretty active right before they pitch down and then kind of go silent there for a little bit, and then they'll pick back up.
Now I'm going to hit you with another scenario, and this is the one that gives me a little chub. So all this happens, and then nothing comes of it. And then you kind of wander around the woods all morning, and around 10 a.m., okay, which is when a lot of turkeys get shot.
Yep.
At least the ones I shoot at. Around 10 a.m., all of a sudden, now what are you thinking?
So before I make a sound, I want to get as close as the terrain and the vegetation will allow before I make a peep. He's just giving up his location. I want to be as silent as I can. I'll get as close as it lets me, and then I'll sit down, and I'm going.
Because he's been out love making the hens all morning. Yep. They all drift off.
And so before that happens, also what's going on in my head is this thing just let off a bugle in the middle of the day by himself. He's probably looking for hens at that point. You know, all the hens went to lay. And so I'm already thinking this is a, you know, not a for sure thing, but my odds are very, very high at that bird. As you mentioned, you're killing them at 10 to noon. Very, very high in that 10 to 2 window when they gobble. So I'm going to go get set up, and I'm going to go to my 7 to 9 note, you know, yelp. And if I can only bring one call in the woods, it would be this, your typical yelp.
So this is what you're hitting middle of the day, hot gobbler.
Yep. So we'll go sit down. And so I'll react to that gobbling a little bit. You know, if he gobbles, I'll maybe try to turn the temperature up with yelps. And then if he becomes disinterested, we'll maybe give it 5-10 minutes and then go back.
Yeah.
I'm not really good at being patient. I say 5 to 10, which is probably like 30 seconds, and then exactly. I'll call again.
Okay, so now here he is, and he shuts up. But you can hear him. Who knows how to make a spitting and drumming?
Boom, boom, boom.
I could do this. It's
yeah.
So you're hearing that, and it just drags on. You're like, what could be going on? Then what are you going to hit them with?
Then we'll switch to real subtle clucks, purrs, maybe, you know, even scratching the ground next to me. A lot of times when I set up, I'll try to bring some brush or some leaves next to me. We'll scratch around, and that just real subtle noise at that time to try to get them to pull in that last 20 or 30 yards or whatever it may be.
Because you're trying to sound like a hen close scratching
content.
Around.
Yeah, that purr and clucks, that real content sound. And so you don't necessarily want to blow them out anymore with that louder yelp or, you know, excited cackles. You're just really trying to get them that last little bit. Or what we've did in some instances, a lot of times we'll play this cat and mouse where you change setups and he just won't come closer. We may give a little call and then we just go silent.
Yeah.
And like, just, all right, you know there's a turkey here. It's in your hands now.
So hit us with some of those more subtle tunes.
That, and as I mentioned to Mark earlier,
it's purring.
That read's not meant to purr. It's more of that yelper read. But, you know, if I had the right read in, we'd do some purring, just those real light, subtle clucks and just real quiet sounds.
Yeah, the first time I ever hunted with a really good turkey caller, that he never did, you know, we were, this is in South Carolina, which is like well known for having wily, cagey turkeys. And dude, he never ripped out. Like everything he would do was just like, just these so subtle little teensy noises. You know, when you're out in the woods and you hear something do with a box call, right? But then the other day I was on YouTube and there's a video of a real live hen who full balls out yelps 62 times in a row. If you were in the woods and heard that, you'd think that is some idiot over there with a box call.
Yep, going crazy on a box.
Yeah.
So, yeah, real subtle sounds when they're in tight. If you can hear spitting and drumming, can't see the bird yet, quiet.
Yep. Now, last thing on turkeys. A couple years ago, hunting in California, I was doing that, calling back and forth to a gobbler, gobbling, I'm calling, and it just drags on. And eventually, I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to go over to a new spot and try to call him to the next ridge. But in traveling over there, it takes a while, so I don't make any noise for 15 minutes to get to the next ridge. By the time I get to the next ridge, I call, and that sumbitch is standing right where I left from.
Yep, exactly.
Because he eventually got curious.
Yep, there was no noise for so long.
He's like, well, what happened to her?
Right on you.
We had such a thing going on. Like, what happened to her? So then I call, and I'm like, oh, now he's gobbling right from where I was sitting. So then I just shut up. And a while later, sure enough, here he's standing there. It just got the
silence,
best of him. Because he enjoys, I think he was enjoying whatever bird version of enjoyment is. He was enjoying that little deal.
Yeah, the game.
Yeah.
Yep.
So make a big plug for Phelps Game Calls, man.
I'm not good at that stuff. But no, so we've got.
I'll do it. Let me take a stab at it.
You go.
Let me take a stab at it. In an American elbow grease story where a guy pounding away, making high quality calls and making a nice, good business, cranking away in his home, builds a business up and makes like phenomenal calls, and insiders know the Phelps calls are right. How's that?
I love it.
No, you do something like that.
like this whole self-promotion thing is just not good with me.
Well, you want to plug someone else's call now?
Yeah. I think some people, you know, listen to your podcast and know the story. It's just been a lot of passion. This whole company's been driven by passion. We wanted to build the better mousetrap, come up with the specific sounds we were looking for, and we're pretty excited. You know, we've did very well with the turkey calls. Our elk calls are our bread and butter still, but we're really excited as we move into the next year. We've got a full predator line, waterfowl line, deer call line. Everything's finally going to be where I kind of envisioned it way back when we started. So we're pretty excited to kind of get out of that elk call rut, turkey call sprinkled in, but we'll have a full turkey call line, and we'll be kind of a complete call company at that point. So
that's excellent. Yeah.
Your fawn call is the most effective black bear call I've ever used, and spring black bear's coming up.
That's coming from Callahan, and we'll get around to intros in a minute. Website
www.phelpsgamecalls.com. We're, you know, for everybody that's on social media, we're very easy to get a hold of. Contact, you know, messages, emails, all of that stuff is on the website and on social media.
Excellent, man. Thanks for coming out and doing Turkey Primer.
Yeah.
We're gonna rush this episode into being so that people can capitalize on that.
All right.
Awesome. On those sweet sounds and sweet notes. Okay. It's a huge room full of people. As though dealing poker, we'll do intros.
It's more like a small room full of people.
Yeah. Small room full of lots of people. Brody, strapping into a set.
Good.
Yeah, hit it. Introduce yourself.
Brody Henderson.
There you go.
Here I am. BHA Rendezvous. Had to drive 10 hours north to leave winter behind.
And it's all nice up here now.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And down in your part of in your neck of the woods?
I almost died like 5 minutes from my house driving yesterday.
Because of snow in Colorado.
Ice, yeah. Snow and ice, yeah.
Right.
Mark Kenyon, here from Michigan.
Mark Kenyon, Wired to Hunt podcast.
Yes, sir. We still have winter at home, too. No good.
Remy Warren. Just hanging. From Reno.
You're on your honeymoon.
I'm on my honeymoon. Actually, I came from Fiji, so it got colder for me.
Ryan Callahan, BHA Rendezvous, podcasting, First Light.
And Mark Boardman.
Yep, Mark Boardman. Work for Vortex Optics out of good old Wisconsin, and yeah, enjoying the lovely weather we're experiencing in Boise at the BHA Rendezvous.
Okay, we're gonna cover a handful of things, but first off, we got a mega correction. Like, people were kind of irate. Like, this is one of the things that, one of the biggest corrections, the biggest wrongs we ever have had is I screwed up and was reading how the house, it's a double layered screw up. Can you explain it, Giannis? While you're doing that, I'll sort of set up the screw up. We were already discussing some issues about baiting in Alabama, where in Alabama you'd always been allowed to do supplemental feeding for deer, but you couldn't bait for hunting purposes. So they came in and tried to clarify the distinction between supplemental feeding for deer and hunting purposes. And once they spelled it out, it seemed to have, according to some people, invited a level of interpretation where it said, for instance, it can't, you know, it has to be 100 yards away from you. Like, you're, if you're hunting, any bait has to be more than 100 yards away from you and has to be out of sight from you from a landscape feature. And a guy wrote in to say, well, people are exploiting this now and putting a bait behind a big hay bale 100 yards away and saying, well, I can't see it, right? And it was causing this confusion. And that led to this other thing where the House in Alabama, the state house, voted to just outright legalize baiting for deer and pigs. And we talked about how that was a new law in Alabama, but in fact, not even kinda. It never made it to vote in the Senate, right? And then it's not a law. Break it down, Yanni. And this is a joke.
You just broke it down. I don't know what else you want me to add. It didn't make it, so it's illegal to bait. Which I'm still weird about, like, the supplemental feeding. Like, I don't really understand that. We should maybe looked into that. But so I guess you can still do that. You can feed wildlife, right?
Yep.
But you can't bait for the sake of hunting. And so this judge that wrote in was saying that they sort of...
Yeah, it was a judge that wrote
when
in.
When they wrote this sort of thing to help clarify, they actually muddied the waters in the process by saying, like, oh, well, if it's, like, more than 100 yards away and you can't see it, then it's not really a bait pile. But he said that he and every other judge that has had to rule on baiting cases, which they do, that they pretty much say, look, man, if at all you can, like, see where that deer or whatever it is that you're hunting is in that zone of that bait pile, like, we're going to call it baiting. We're going to call it what it is.
Yeah.
If it's on the other side of a ridge from you, we're not going to call it baiting.
But a hay bale 100 yards away, which is what someone wrote to us to say people do, is clearly illegal.
Yeah.
Like, not a natural landscape feature. So there's that. And that brings up a quick question for Mark Kenyon. A guy wrote in to ask this, and it makes me think of it right now. Why is, in the whitetail world, you're a big whitetail fella.
They call me a whitetail guy. You call me a whitetail guy, I guess.
Yeah, you called yourself a whitetail freak, I think, one time.
That might be true.
So Mark, like, if you don't know it, like, if you dig on whitetails and just all things whitetails, Mark's Wired Hunt podcast is what you ought to be listening to, because Mark goes way beyond anything we even get close to when it comes to talking about whitetails, which is what, you know, it's America's hunting this animal, right? But a question that I would like you to take on, Mark, a guy wrote in and say, why is, in some circles, why is bait bad but food plots are not bad?
Yeah.
That's something you got to have been asked 1,000 times.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big thing. People that don't like bait haters like to pose that question a lot, because there's a lot of controversy.
You say people that don't like bait haters.
Right, so yeah, there's a lot of people that hate on people that use bait. And those guys that do bait like to say, well, you're a hypocrite because you plant food plots. So you are changing the landscape or doing something that is attracting deer away from their natural patterns to a new place.
Yeah. And so where do you stand on this? Are you a bait hater?
I'm not a bait hater.
Okay.
But I'm not a bait user. So I don't like to bait, but my dad does. So whatever. More power to you. You can do whatever you prefer to do. I would rather not. But I do plant food plots, because for me, that is two things. Number one, with a food plot, with a habitat improvement, you're putting in there's a whole lot of work and thought and effort going into that. So it feels like you're, I don't know, going through some threshold of, like, work put into something that I don't feel like you achieve the same as dumping a pile of corn. Number two, you're
okay, that's not going to resonate. That's not going to do much for people.
That's just me. Okay. I'm not trying to prove a point here, but But you're also improving the habitat. You're, by planting a food plot, you're benefiting entire landscape, an entire ecosystem. You're doing something above and beyond just the sole purpose of shooting something once. You plant a food plot, you're improving the situation for 365 days a year for so many different animals, for so many different things. You might take one life off that, etc. So that might be another argument for the fact that they're different. But if you want to say that you're changing something to bring deer in, and if that's the only thing you're looking at, then yeah, you could say that food plots and baiting are the same. You're not hunting just a natural, completely natural, unaltered pattern.
What I thought you were going to say is that it's a little bit different because the size.
Well, that too. Well, from a disease perspective, if that's another thing you want to talk about.
Yeah, I thought you'd hit me with that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So an issue with baiting that a lot of people talk about is you put something in a very small concentrated area that attracts a lot of deer to that same very small concentrated area. There's a higher chance of disease spreading, like CWD, which is the big thing, of course, everyone's talking about. So because of that, a lot of states have banned baiting to try to reduce the chance of that spread. With a food plot, some people will say, well, it's the same thing with a food plot. You're pulling deer into an area, but it's just, it's different. It's a much larger space. You're going to have deer congregate around natural food sources anyways. So there's only so much you can do there. So if it's, even if it's a quarter acre food plot, that's still resembling a natural feeding environment versus a 1 yard square section where you might have a pile of corn where you get all these noses touching,
yeah,
all the saliva.
Do any states come in? Is there any state that's banned or tried to regulate food plots?
No.
Why? What's up, Ryan?
Yeah, I feel like Montana addressed that, didn't they? If you plant specifically to harvest animals on, it's based on intent, but I don't think you can do that.
Really?
I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure you can't.
There's a lot of regulations with waterfowl.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like you couldn't grow corn, cut corn, and shoot ducks unless you have an agricultural reason to do so.
Yeah, we were talking, and then we were talking about this not long ago that like you couldn't grow corn, pick it, scatter it on the ground, right?
Yeah.
And hunt ducks, but in places you can grow corn and leave it unpicked, but you can't knock it. And it's like, you can't knock it down.
Right.
But it's possible that you could grow it and never harvest it as long as you don't knock it down. And weird.
Yeah. If you planted it solely to attract animals, then I don't think it would be legal in Montana based on, but I could be wrong. So I'd maybe have to research.
No, that's right. Like you said, it's based on the agricultural reason. And so like an agricultural reason could be I'm leaving that stand of corn because corn prices have fallen, or the moisture level, the moisture content within the ear of corn never got down to a harvestable percentage. So there's reasons for again, screw it, just leave it standing versus spending a bunch of gas to go out there and cut the stuff down.
Yeah.
When I will have no return on my investment.
Now, Mark, can you define a food plot real quick?
I guess a general definition would be some type of crop planted with the specific purpose of either attracting an animal to it and or supplementing nutrition. So that could be something like clover or kale or rape or soybeans or corn or winter wheat, anything like that.
Are you sensitive when people bring up the comparison of food plots debate?
No, I don't care. I mean, I understand the argument. It doesn't hold water for me, but I get. But even if it did, that's all right. You can choose to see it that way. I'll do my thing. You do yours.
I got another whitetail deer thing for you.
I got another answer.
Well, Brody, sketch this deal out.
So last fall in Pennsylvania, an archery hunter was hunting public land, had a bunch of trail cameras set up, was pretty familiar with.
Can you pause 1 second?
Yeah.
Do you already know what we're talking about?
I don't.
Really? Okay, go on, Brody.
You should. It sounds like this guy's a pretty dedicated archery hunter from knowing, you know, what we've read about it. But he's hunting public land, trail cameras. he puts an arrow in a pretty gigantic buck, especially considering it was shot in Pennsylvania, which is like a heavily hunted state.
Yeah, you could call it a big, huge, giant buck.
Yeah, on public land in Pennsylvania, it's impressive. And Pennsylvania's seeing more big bucks because they went to antler restrictions a while back. But either way, he sticks an arrow in this deer and does not find it. It sounds like it may have been a questionable shot. No one really knows. Either way, he doesn't find the deer. And 41 days goes by. And he finds, eventually, you know, he kept looking for the buck. Finds the buck 41 days later. Archery season has ended. He may have found it during rifle season. I think he did. But he puts his tag on a desiccated carcass that had been picked over by predators. The only thing that's left is the spine, the skull, and the antlers. Tags the antlers, and eventually word gets out. The guy gets the buck measured. Pennsylvania Game and Fish Commission confirms it as the new state record archery kill.
What do you think about that, Mark Kenyon?
That's cool.
Really?
But there's new state records in states like every year now. It seems like I can't keep track of
but
them.
But that's not the question.
Yeah.
Are you not getting the question?
No, what's the question?
Does
that count? 41 days later?
Is it an archery kill?
Whoa.
Is it a hunter killed record versus a found
41 days later?
There is
a place in the record. And I don't know. I'd like to have this guy on the show.
So you did.
I would love to get this guy on the show to talk to you about this because here's like.
A meteorite could have fallen from the sky and struck that animal.
41 yeah. days.
But then when do you set the, where's the line?
I don't know.
So
I don't know.
8 hours.
8 hours.
No.
Okay. I mean, if it was up to
was
me.
It
the,
kill, like, what killed it? Infection? Coyotes?
Right. I mean, I have a similar situation that happened to me.
Me too.
One of the best deer I ever shot. It was a poor shot, unfortunately. And then I found it.
It was a what shot?
Poor.
Oh.
Shot. But I thought he's going to die. So I searched and searched and searched and searched and searched. Never found him until I came back in February to shed hunt. And there he is right in his bedroom where he usually was.
So do you act like you found, did you find it or get it?
So the way I would describe it is that, I killed him, but I always say I found him in February.
So let's say that buck was a big giant record buck.
Yeah.
Would you turn it in as a record buck or would you look at it on your wall and be like, damn, I made a bad shot on that buck?
So that I found his skull and his spine, everything there, got a salvage tag from the DNR, brought it home. And then a friend of mine had an extra cape. He said, hey man, this is a buck that kind of like my Holyfield deal. I'd hunted this buck for 2 or 3 years, knew him really well, had been chasing this thing forever. And this whole thing happened. My friend's like, man, you have so much like emotion wrapped up in that deer. You should mount him. I want to give you my cape. So I thought about it and I was like, I don't know. But in the end, I decided to do it and I put it on my wall so that every time I walk past that thing, I always think about never make that mistake again. Like never, don't screw up, practice more. Compose yourself. Like every little thing I have second guessed or thought through that I might have did wrong on that evening. Now I rethink that.
Yeah, it's your totem of self flag. How's that word?
Flagellation.
Self flagellation.
Yeah. So it's
whooping
like a,
yourself.
Yeah, it's like a powerful. It's a powerful representation of like what was a really painful like moment. It was like a high when I got that shot at this deer I've been after, and then the mistake, and then the.
So let's say a dude walks in and he's like, hey, you know what? Turns out that's the new state record. Would you say, well, no?
I'd say, I don't know. I don't know where that line is. I definitely wouldn't try to promote it as a state record. I wouldn't have like turned it in to try to get it as a state record.
Now, this happened to my old man too. And it was not, I don't remember how, it was enough days where he hit a deer out of his tree. It was a nice buck, especially for like that era in Michigan. He shot a deer right below him and no exit wound. Weeks later, my brother Danny's walking out the rifle hunt and finds the deer. And it hadn't gone far. It went into a cornfield and we must have walked over it 100 times, walked around it, even to the point where it was so baffling how we could have missed it that we entertained this idea that he had left and then days later came back. But then when you look at the placement of the arrow, that's just, that's doesn't make sense. We just missed him, right? And I don't know, he found it weeks later, but he entered it. He entered it in. If you went and looked his like commemorative bucks of Michigan or whatever, his name's in there with that buck. And all he did, he took the head off it, had to go find a cape. I remember the winter we were out hunting rabbits. We dropped in to take a look at that buck, and there was a hole bored in the side of it from critters getting in there. And I looked in there and found a possum denned up in there. Pulled him out by his tail and took a, I still have a picture of me holding that possum up by his tail. So he entered that buck in, and now looking at it, like when you're a little kid, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't, now looking at him, I'm like, yeah, I don't know, man. You like, you didn't really get him.
Yeah.
You found, it's like a thing you found. You didn't get him.
It's a really interesting question, though, because you, I guess it depends on like the shot. Like if you know that that shot killed that deer, but is getting him, meaning that the killing of that deer and the recovering of it in a certain time span, or yes. Is it killing it and, I mean, and then to your question, you don't know when that deer died. If it died the next day, or if it died then and you just missed it, or if it died a week later, but it was because of the wound. I hate this whole conversation, because the idea of wounding a deer and this being a long, drawn-out process is a horrible thing to talk about.
Yeah, but it's the thing that happens, so I don't like it to is. Act like it doesn't happen.
It does happen.
So what we'll do, I want to go, okay, so picture this scenario that you're the commander of the world.
Yeah.
And as commander of the world, it comes to you that you need to say, we're going to put a time limit on it.
Yeah. I would say 7 days.
Really?
Arbitrarily.
Okay, here's my thought. Can you hear me all right?
Oh, yeah, I got you.
So I have a couple questions just to clarify, because it's really going to decide on how he's...
Well,
so
if you're talking about the deer, Brody's the resident expert.
Right, so this particular deer, maybe I missed this, but... Did that guy that shot that deer, like say he shot that deer and he killed that deer, right? But he doesn't, I don't know how long the season is. Maybe it's too short of a season for this to happen, but this could happen in Montana where if you don't recover your deer, it's not illegal to shoot another deer in many states.
Yeah.
But it's, I would consider it unethical. But if that guy shot another deer in that deer's place, so he gets up in the tree stand, he shoots that buck, he doesn't find it in 2 days. He goes, I didn't find it, right? Another buck walks by, he arrows that buck, punches his tag, and puts it on that deer. Or, now, I would say that guy can claim it if he, like, right then goes, I killed that deer, he cuts his tag, and goes, I'm going to look until I find that deer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If he was, like, diligent and goes, I'm going to look until I find that deer, then it's like, all right, he made a bad shot, he reconciled it, that's his deer, he punched his tag on it, now he looks for it. And yeah. It took him 6 weeks to do it. That really sucks, but he put in the effort. Good on him. He knew he killed it. That's his. But if he's like the next morning, oh, a little spiker walks by and he shoots it, punches a tag on that, and then finds that deer later.
That doesn't
I would
sound
say
like
it's
that,
the exact
that's
opposite.
That's not the lad. The former version happened. It was the former version. I don't know if he hunted anymore.
I don't know if he kept. I mean, he was out during rifle season when he tagged it, I believe.
Hunting so, or looking?
Well, who knows?
Oh, I'd love to have this guy out.
I mean, there's so many details you can't clear up, but he, you know, in order to register this buck for a record, he had to put a tag on it, and he tagged the skull, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he went above and beyond legal and ethical obligations to find the thing, but if I was commander of the world, it would be like, you got to find that thing. In order to register it, you got to find it in time to use the meat. That would be my cutoff.
But like,
well, I tend to agree. But again, let's say you get a hit and you're like, man, not a great hit. I'm going to let it go overnight. It's going to get cool tonight. I'm going to let it go overnight because I think that it's going to give me a better chance of finding it than if I bump it.
Right.
And then coyotes. You go out and coyotes got
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So there, here's a guy. He's got like a whole plan. He's doing everything right. He goes out beyond his control. Coyotes got it.
Right.
I would say to that dude, I'm like, you got it.
Yeah.
You got the buck. It's your buck.
It's 100 yards
it's
from
the tree. It's unfortunate that happened. You were probably aware that was a risk. It probably rolled through your mind based on everything you had going for you, everything that you were dealing with, your buck.
Yeah,
yeah. I take back my previous declaration as commander of the world. I like Brody's better.
I mean, in an ideal situation.
I want everyone to just put a time stamp on it. I'm going to say, as commander, I'm talking about God putting a gun to your head and you saying, and he says, you have to tell me a time period, 48 hours.
I like that.
With great reluctance, I would say 48 hours.
Because I do think that, you know, with that meat aspect fits into that in most cases, barring very warm weather, that kind of stuff.
Various snafus.
Yeah. But so maybe I'm just unfamiliar with Pennsylvania rules. Or is it because it was a bow? Because Boone and Crockett, half the things in there, most of the world records are pickup skulls.
Well, that's what I wanted to get into, too. Like, explain what that, explain
yeah,
that.
Like the new world record, bighorn sheep was found on that island out in Flathead.
Yeah.
Everybody knew, I mean, that sheep was pretty much a high fence sheep. He's on this little island out in the lake, and there's a million pictures of it. And then that sheep dies, and then the state of Montana has the new world record.
Yeah, and I've been, you've been like, on that island?
Yeah. Well, I've been on it. Yeah,
exactly. You can walk around petting those sheep.
Yeah. So
now and then a bear, a black bear will swim out there. There's a bunch of fruit trees out there. And now and then a black bear will swim out there when the fruit trees are in blossom. So imagine they do deal with some level of like
the natural
stress. Yeah. But you go out there. Yeah. You just can go out there and sort of almost walk up and, you know.
Yeah. So
hang out with them.
So I guess I
was like, when I saw that that's the new world record, I'm like, okay, well, is the Bronx Zoo going to beat that record next?
Could. That's
the whole thing. Is it hunter killed or is it found? And Pennsylvania, like a lot of states, and Boone and Crockett, they have different categories, right? Like hunter killed animals and picked up animals, even sheds, right?
Right.
So I think the question everyone's got about this buck is, was it hunter killed or was it found?
So my answer to that would be simple. When he walked out there, did he find it? Yes, he found it. There you go.
Who?
The guy. He would say that he found it during rifle season.
He didn't recover it.
He didn't recover it during rifle season. He found it. You can't recover something months later. You find it.
I mean, exactly. Ah. If you were to go missing in the woods, right? It's
if I was dead,
if I was rescue, or it's a recovery,
right?
If you recovered Steve's chopped up carcass.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Can you hand Phelps your deal?
So just the argument of finding it, like we use blood, we use tracks, we use broken twigs. So he didn't recover it. He found it, like Remy said. There's some key ingredients to finding a buck versus recovering a buck. And
yeah.
So I would say he definitely found it.
All right, but Jason Phelps, in the whole thing where you had to put an hour, like you were forced to put a time limit on it or else you're going to get, you know, killed.
48 hours, but you have to look for it in all daylight hours up until that point. Like, there needs to be some effort involved. Like, if you wound to make a bad shot, there needs to be some effort involved. So, 2 days, but you better spend those 2 days looking for it.
Yeah. Mark Borman?
Oh, man. I'm going to back up here a sec because there's a lot of twists and turns to this thing. So,
as they say, it starts to make its own gravy.
That's exact. So, I'm going to say when he found this buck, was he actively searching for it or did he stumble upon it?
Don't know. That's why I'd like to talk to
Jason's point. Was he reading that sign? Was he, you know, going over in his head, like, you know, like, okay, I think he might have bedded here,
was he in the act of looking?
Well, was he in the act of looking?
He had shot the thing. He knew it was potentially dead in the area. And I think it was a continual process of hoping he would eventually stumble across those antlers.
Gotcha. So he wasn't in his hunter orange during the rifle season.
I don't know all the details. I mean he was continuing to look for it. But it's not as if 41 days later he was thinking he was hunting that buck. I don't think.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean odds are, right, that buck died as a direct relationship to being hit with that arrow, but I
could have been, who knows?
Well, there's so many unknowns. Like you said, there's so many unknowns. That's a lot of time. Did somebody else put an arrow in that deer as it wandered by his stand and he didn't find it too? You know, I mean,
yeah.
Maybe caught a little EHD in the meantime. I don't know.
yeah, it's, you know.
And I'm not trying to take anything away from this guy.
No, man, I would like, to, like I said, I would love to chat with him because I'd just be curious his perspective on it.
Guy's ears, this is,
I'm not dogging on the guy whatsoever.
No way.
It just is a really interesting situation.
It's it's a totally interesting topic.
Here's another one, another perplexing one. And again, Mark, this has to do, this. I'm sorry, but this comes down to Mark Kenyon.
It's okay, because whitetails are the most hunted species in North America.
This isn't whitetails.
Of course, the attention should be on us.
This isn't whitetails.
Can I tell you a story? Someone walked up to me yesterday, and they said, so get this. I was at a bar.
This is someone telling you this.
Yeah, someone's telling me a story. So I'm speaking as the storyteller. The storyteller walks up to me and says, I was at this bar for a BHA pint night, and he saw me wearing this public landowner shirt. The guy walks up to me, and he says,
I'm confused. Who are you being right now?
I'm the storyteller.
You're you.
No.
Okay, I'll be you.
Oh. I'm telling a story of a guy telling me a story of a story. So it's confusing. But you're me. Okay.
Yeah.
I am the person that I just talked to yesterday.
No, I understand.
Hey, Mark.
Go ahead.
I was at a pint. I was at a pint night in the UP, and this guy walked up to me, and he saw me wearing my public landowner shirt, and he says to me, "Hey, you're wearing that public landowner shirt. It'd be really cool if you could get Mark Kenyon to come up here and talk about that kind of stuff. Or if you can't get him, maybe Steve Rinella." I thought, man, all right, they got the ranking right.
Yeah, it wasn't like when Remy got to be the boss gobbler.
Yeah. I was like, that's the first time that's ever been said.
Okay, so, all right, this is out of your comfort zone, but it's just something I heard from Brody that you just said.
Really?
Yeah, Brody, can you lay the groundwork again, Brody?
Remember what we were talking about last night?
I don't. I mean, we talked about the spawning trout.
Dude, this is the most baffling. Okay, the other night, Brody sends me an article, and it's a guy, I don't want to talk about who he is. It's a guy griping about, all right, it's so complicated. You can already tell he's got an axe grind because he's griping about social media people, okay?
Gear ambassadors.
How they ruin everything, and they like to take pictures of big, huge, giant trout, and he knows the truth that they catch these big trout when they're spawning. And Brody, who's a guides catch release trout fisherman, sends it to me, annoyed about the perspective on it, and Brody brings up to me, like, why is it that the whole world, everything they fish, everyone's always fishing the spawn? People travel great distances to fish steelhead when they're in a river spawning. You fish salmon in the river spawning. People plan trips to fish bluegill off the beds.
You throw a jig into a bass bed.
Yeah.
Everyone fishes spawning fish. But all of a sudden, like, trout purists have gone and said this whole huge history of people targeting fish when they congregate to spawn is unethical if it's a brown trout. And you agree with that?
Oh, no, I didn't.
I thought
that's what Brody told me.
You and Brody said that was an unethical practice.
No, the way I was saying supposedly, because I don't know. I'm just learning this. So I just taught myself to fly fish over the last few years. So I've never really been a big trout fisherman until just recently. I was telling the crowd about this article I read. And so I was saying they were saying this is supposedly unethical. And I was looking at you like, hey, right? I don't know.
Brody must have been drunk. That's not what he told me.
No, yeah, I got the impression that
Brody came up to me. He's like, "Dad, Kenyon,
it was unethical."
I was like, "Is that the case?" I have no clue. So reading that, like, I'm just fishing. I don't know.
I don't get it. Callahan, please go ahead.
Everybody's right and everybody's wrong. Okay. Yeah, and we have certainly built up this hierarchy of species. That's nothing new. But there comes a point where, okay, so there's this river around here. It's called the Lost.
Yeah.
Tailwater fishery below the dam. And there comes a point where you cannot hardly walk in that river, wade in that river without standing in a red, in a spawning bed.
Okay.
At the same time, the water is 18 inches deep and you can see every single fish. I do not find it ethical to then go fish for those fish because you can drag them foul hook. You can hook them in the back and drag them off that bed.
Or floss them.
Yeah. And then they'll turn around and go right back to that bed and sit on it.
So what's the problem?
The problem is it's, I mean, that's not fishing.
Okay. So when a little kid,
if there's
when a little
fishing,
kid goes down to his mom's dock,
not catching.
When a little kid goes down to his mom's dock and there's a dozen bluegill beds in knee deep water, and not only will they feed, but they'll aggressively guard their nest. And he lobs a worm into that collection of bluegill beds. Is he being unethical? I mean, come on.
So I have a question.
I mean, this is the nature of this discussion, right? It's like, first of all, the stuff that you flatlanders do, I mean, who really cares, right?
Yeah. There's that.
Right? So like the crappie, the bluegill, the bass, for some reason we have us, as a Rocky Mountain West society, have decided that that stuff just doesn't matter as much as our trout do. And maybe that has something to do with like recovering populations.
Yeah, but you're talking about non-native, like rainbows and browns. Like, first of all, they're not disappearing anytime soon, and they don't technically belong in any of these.
They're
rivers.
Synthetic
no,
fish.
No, they don't.
They're synthetic fish.
Purely synthetic fish. Yeah, but so look at the frickin' pike minnow, right? The squaw fish, squawkers. Yeah.
No, those I will not mess with on the bed.
Completely native fish. There's a bounty on their heads below the Bonneville Dam.
Yeah,
they're
in Colorado. They're endangered. You can't so it's all relative.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they're endangered in Colorado.
Yeah, people are chucking them on the banks.
The guy
here
that wrote this article, the guy that we kind of all apparently read or got forwarded around, was referring to browns.
Yes, that was in Colorado,
an imported Wyoming. Wyoming.
Oh, this
Wyoming.
Is where it makes more gravy, like Steve says. How it read to me was as much as this guy was concerned with the ethics of ripping spawners off of a bed, he was more concerned with dudes from out of state coming in and screwing up the fishery that he guides on. So it was like, well,
I could have been out on that spawning bed making money.
Right. Right.
You know, the thing that I took away from it, though, was just the fact, I thought the point he was making was how people are putting ethics, or they're crossing lines to try to get famous, like Instagram famous.
Right.
He was talking about how more and more people are doing these huge photo shoots with every big fish because they want that huge photo and they want to be in the cover of whatever. They want a free pair of sunglasses or something. So you see people standing around for 2 minutes holding that fish out of the water. Or you see people, in this case, he said that they were going down a closed stretch of river. They knew it was closed, but they still went down it. They had to pass signs that said it was closed. I don't remember why it was closed
that's,
or anything.
Okay. That's a different story. That's called poaching.
So that he was making that argument, I thought, that
but
people were doing things like that to get
but
famous.
The one particular
media.
Fish in question was caught. I mean, this guy did all kinds of illegal stuff. But there is like a greater picture of just generally fishing for spawning trout being like something you should go to hell for.
See, I thought he was using that as the story to illustrate the larger.
Yeah, well, okay, he wasn't the most masterful writer in the world. So I feel that he's got a few axes to grind. He's kind of in a grumpy mood. He doesn't like it. Maybe he's going to hate this. There's probably like a fair bit of jealousy involved. A little bitterness, okay? And you put all these ingredients together, and you get kind of a rant. And just as he's taking, he's talking about the influence of social media on fishing, and an example of that would be that you would be so audacious as to catch a spawning trout to up your social media presence, okay? As much as he's taking that little isolated example to prove a larger point, I'm doing the same thing he did when I'm plucking out one portion of this, is to say, like, to declare that you targeting a particular species of imported European fish during its spawn as being unethical, how does that relate to all of the fish that we all sort of agree you do fish during the spawn? And has the gentleman that wrote that article, I'm presumably if he's a fishing guide in Wyoming, he's a pretty seasoned angler. Presumably he's been up to Alaska or BC and fished a king in the river. Who's there to lay his eggs. Her eggs.
So I guess the difference is let's say you have this catch and release fishery. Okay. The fish come up and spawn. They're on their beds. They get through the spawning process, but then they're guarding their beds. And they're not eating, but they're doing that aggressive behavior of knocking other fish off the beds and you're fishing eggs. Sometimes they're trying to knock eggs off their bed, other fish's eggs off their beds. And there is a time of year where there's eight of us in this room. We could walk up that river and all eight of us could catch that exact same fish somehow, some way, because it's going to go back to that bed and it's going to sit on that bed and it's going to do its job. And, you know, we could stress it out to the point very easily where it's going to die.
Okay.
So why would that be allowed in this catch and release fishery where the point is to try to release them and let them get caught again?
But if you're out there fishing, presumably not for those spawners, it's legal to be out there fishing. And you're out fishing, not targeting those particular spawners, and you're pointing at the dude who is. But you're out there fishing, and you're catching pre-spawn fish, and you scoop up a female that hasn't spawned yet, and she spews a bunch of eggs out in the net. Who, like, where do you draw the line? Like, if you don't think you should be fishing for spawning fish, then advocate for closing it all together, right? Like, nobody should be out there in that case.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you catch them 10 days before they spawn or when they're on their bed.
I don't think that's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're correct. Yeah, why we do not do that, I do not know.
You want to know how we used to target spring bullheads? You know, bullheads like to spawn.
Like a catfish?
Yeah, they like to spawn in cavities. So busted up seawalls, hollow logs, anything they can get inside, and they turn around so their head's looking out to defend the nest. We wouldn't even use a rod. You just go around and dingle, wrap some line around your hand and dingle a little Cleo against his face and have him grab it. To the point we'd sometimes dive down, snorkel and mask, dive down and then dingle it in front of him.
Wow.
See, so that's like, right? Now I'm looking and being like, man, that was so unethical. But I'm just not feeling it.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling the guilt.
I think if you're going to try to eat the thing, fine. But if not, like, I feel like there's a reasonable chance of failure when you eliminate all those chances of failure by being like, okay, big fish, 10 inches of water. I can throw a rock in there. It's going to run away, but it's going to come right back to that at the exact same spot. Chances are I can catch this fish. Like,
yeah,
at what point is it still fishing?
I want to do, but maybe for the guy who only gets to fish a few days a year.
And he's got to get a lot of social media followers.
Yeah, man. Like, you got to make it happen.
I got to jump in here because I grew up like Cal did, fishing.
Pitchfork and spawning browns. No. Out of the
I mean,
you know,
trout
stuff.
Fishing, you know, bass fishing wasn't a thing. And maybe it's just regional because you just, if I was in a lake, right, and there's a stream coming into that lake, you'll see 100 fishermen away from that. No one will be going and fishing those fish off their beds.
Really?
It's like, why don't you just go? So if a fish swims upstream, why don't you just go pick it up? Yeah. And then, like, go take a picture with it. Like, is that fishing?
Yeah.
I mean, it's too easy. It takes out, you might as well just go, like, buy your fish or go, like, put them in a swimming pool. Because those trout aren't, like, I don't know. But when I first started bass fishing, I would never cast at a fish that was on its bed, ever. I didn't know that. I was like, oh, you just don't do that.
Oh, we'd go get leeches and lay them on the beds.
Yeah, I mean, now I do that because I understand that that's how you fish bass. But I'm like, bass fishermen must just, like, have – they just don't care enough or whatever.
Those,
it's different.
Well, no, fish are so sturdy.
They're so sturdy, yeah. You – like, trout are very fragile. It's – like, my parents – or I grew up at this small kind of man-made private lake and we stocked, and you could just see that trout die fast. It's very hard for trout to exist. And especially when you're talking in Montana, you're talking cutthroats or native fish. If you see that fish on the bed, you need those fish to have a fighting chance. Now, fishing other places like pre-spawn, most of the fish that are on the bed, they're waiting for those eggs that are laid. A lot of those eggs have been fertilized.
Right.
So though they already have that fertilization, they're already ready to hatch. They're that further step from the fish that's just out in the deep swimming around. They constantly produce eggs. So for
the fish that gets in the net spews its eggs and you let it back go, she's going to have just as many eggs tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's my...
No, I'm with you. Have you guys ever read Shadows on the Koyukuk by the anthropologist Richard K. Nelson?
No, but I will say salmon, they're going to die, so you can just scoop them out of the river. I don't care.
That's another part of this. It's another part of this.
I'm going to throw... I feel like I've been living in a gray area with a million different caveats for the last
trout,
hour.
You're a trout angler.
Yeah, I love to fish for trout. But I'm going to throw another twist in there that we were talking about last night. So where we live in Wisconsin, we have the tribs that dump into Lake Michigan, which to my knowledge, by and large, the steelhead that return to those rivers do not successfully spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, from an ethics standpoint, many people say, I won't fish to those fish that are on their reds.
Even though it's an artificially supported fishery.
Artificially supported fishery, and those fish aren't going to successfully spawn.
You've got those kind of artificial fisheries all over the Great Lakes, where it's like, yeah, man, we pound these salmon and steelhead while they spawn, and then the state stocks little 6-inch smolts, and it starts all over again, you know? Yeah.
So what do you think of that?
I mean, I just think it's interesting. I mean, I'm not really seeing from a resource standpoint, like, yeah, I mean, I guess you could harass that fish enough, or to Remy's point, you know, if you caught it and stressed it out to a point that it wouldn't return to the lake, then you're down a fish, right? But I mean, there's like, you know, oftentimes there'll be, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 fish waiting in the bucket right behind those spawners that guys are fishing to. And, you know, 10 minutes later, that fish could be pushing up on a red, you know, right near in that same spot. So I just feel like it's a super gray area. And then to your point, like,
it's grayer and gray, man.
So all of a sudden you're a kid. Well, of course I'll let a kid do that. Well, I mean, just like every little thing changes it, you know?
I've seen it, like, it gets so bad in some places. We would go up and fish the North Platte River in April when the rainbows are spawning hard. And the local guides there would, like, if they saw you fishing to spawners, they'd just, like, scream at you. But then those same guys, there'd be, like, a 100-yard stretch of beds. And those same guys will float over top of those fish in their drift boat to knock them down into the next hole, and then they'll get out and fish for them.
I want to get back to Richard K. Nelson real quick in a minute, but here's why I brood over the subject. Because the foundation of fishing it was a food acquisition activity, right? Everyone accepts that, right? So it was like, it comes out of an interplay of life and death. And to watch a segment of fishing become so civilized and so sort of mechanical, where you're fetishizing introduced non-natives, you're establishing this whole other structure of, it's like wrong to utilize these resources in a certain way. It's no longer like the goal of with hunting and fishing, the goals used to be that you would study an animal, you would study it and find its vulnerabilities and exploit those vulnerabilities to some extent, and timing issues. Like, people like to hunt bucks during the rut because they don't act like they do normally. They lose some of their inhibitions. They travel more during the daytime. They're more vulnerable. And it's like a whole culture is built around exploiting this vulnerability. But to all of a sudden get to the spot where like this segment of the fishing world becomes so divorced from the foundational reality of what it is, that it sets up this whole other bizarre structure. I don't think it's wrong. I just look at it and I brood over it. It's puzzling to me. In Shadows on the Koyukuk, which is about the Koyukon people, Richard K. Nelson spent some time with them, and they're den dig for bears. So their bear hunting method is, you kind of get a sense, it's handed down generation to generation, all the bear denning locations. And knowing that a den doesn't usually get used twice in a row, you kind of like keep a track of what den might have a bear, and you go around the late spring, and that's how you hunt. You dig bears out. It's unethical to just shoot a bear walking around. Any person can do that. It takes a special man to go in and drag a bear up out of its den and kill it. Right?
Amen.
So if you went and asked most people, if I went out to my buddies that I hunt with and was like, oh yeah, what I do, you know, I go down, I just kill them right in the den. Right? You'd be skewered as the epitome of unethical behavior. So it is, it's just like, in certain cases, it's so arbitrary. And there's so much baggage at play.
Absolutely. And I'm just thinking here, like, how hypocritical I am, right? Because I will not fish to that fish that I can see, that I know is not going to move. Because, like, I'm just like, well, it's a foregone conclusion. But when the water's all murky and muddy, and I've been telling you for years how much I've been enjoying fishing for these smallmouth bass, well, the reason they're so susceptible to flies, a fly rod, is because they've moved up into their spawning area. But the difference is, you know, I'm fishing in 8 feet of water that's murky and I can't see them. And so for some reason, that's the mental difference for me, is the, you know, my percentage of being successful is in this, you know, reasonable area for me of, you know, it's still a game of chance in a way.
Still feels mysterious.
Sporting.
Everyone has that, though. I mean, Steve, if you like could have anything in your tackle box, would dynamite be your number one choice? Would you be like, every time I go fishing, I just throw a stick of jelly in there and blow them out of the water?
No.
You wouldn't do that.
That's correct.
You know, it's because it's guaranteed. It's like fishing for a trout on its bed is so guaranteed that it's not even sporting. It's like you're sportsman because you do it in a certain way. Whether it's legal or not, you've got, everybody has their own code of ethics. And it's like, okay, what might be acceptable to one person isn't acceptable to another. But also, what's the intent behind it? If your intent was, I just want a picture of a big fish, light the dynamite, throw it in there, pull your big fish up, take a picture. You're like, whatever.
You know, yeah, no, I see what you're saying, man. I see what you're saying.
I'm going to kill that fish, but oh, he swam away. He's just in shock. He'll be all right.
If I thought the question was that easy, I wouldn't have brought it up.
Yeah,
it's one of those things, I don't even really know how I feel about it. But it's a good point.
It's a perfect topic for this time of year. I mean, I literally got a call on, I think on Monday, from a guide buddy of mine in Montana who's like, yeah, man, when you coming up? Land of Giants. Like, we're going to go out there. He's like, feel kind of bad fishing them on the reds, but everybody else is.
Really?
Yeah.
This is a conversation you just had.
Just had. Yeah, I mean, it's that time of year.
When I live in the Great Lakes, we'd fish steelhead starting Thanksgiving, sometimes, depending on the water levels. Because a lot of times steelhead would shoot up the rivers when the fall rains came and steelhead would push up. But the whole time, it was all just prelude. It was all prelude to the spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting down there at dawn, and it starts to get light enough that you can start to see the reds. The clean, you know, the spawning beds, you can start to see that golden, clean area. And all of a sudden that gray shadow pulls across that thing. The feeling of like, dude, yes, 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 yes.
It is on.
Right? The feeling you'd get, no one's there, you got the spot, and you see that, just that little shadow come out on there and move away. Oh my God. To have someone come and tell me that I was wrong. I'm not open to it. Okay, moving on real quick. Everybody's cool on that. Mark Canyon, another quick thing. I'm glad to have you here.
I'm getting beat up.
So your famous deer, your famous Holyfield deer, isn't dead.
He's not dead.
Okay, so if you listen to Wired to Hunt, if you go back in the backlog, you hear that Mark's got this whole story of chasing this deer around, the same deer he sees. He's like basically roommates with him. but it's a mysterious deer. And he's had opportunities in the past to get him and didn't get him. Then you thought he was dead.
Yeah.
And then what, you just found his shed and he's not dead?
Yeah. Well, yeah, last time I was doing a podcast with you guys, I was talking about how had my missed opportunity at him and everything. And then like a month later, I think I was talking to you about, I heard from a
friend of a friend that the neighbor shot a big one. This was the only, like, quote unquote, big buck that I'd seen in the area for like 3 years. So it had to be that deer. So I thought, oh yeah, he's dead. He disappeared off trail camera. I didn't see him in times of year. I usually see him after that. So yeah, it kind of moved on. And then randomly.
Oh, you mourned his loss.
I don't know if I mourned his loss, but I came to terms with the fact that this part of my life was done. And yeah, like late February, I think it was, I just was like, I need to go get some fresh air, take the dog for a walk. So went out to this property, just thought I'd walk just kind of the outside little edge, just a nice little spot, and snow on the ground. Wasn't looking for shed antlers or anything, and just stumbled on to some, I was in a nice little stand of pines, and I just saw this crown of tines sticking out of the snow. Pull it up, and lo and behold, he's still around. There he was.
I love it.
It was exciting. It was awesome. It was a little bit bittersweet because a tiny bit of me was relieved when I'd like come to terms with him being gone. Cause I was like, all right, I can move on. Like I'm gonna go hunt some different places, I'm gonna do some different stuff, and I found, I'm like, oh shit, I'm back to this again.
So now your whole next year's all planned out. You gotta try to find this buck.
Well, you know what I'm telling myself now is that I'm not gonna do what I did last year. I'm not going to like change all my, I'm not going to put all my eggs in that basket. I would love to finish this 4 year journey now. I'd love to kill this deer, but I'm not going to let it like consume my life. It's not going to be the end all be all. I'm going to do a lot of different things. Yeah, I'm going to hunt smart. Yeah, I'm still going to try to target that deer and see what happens. But like you said some number of months ago, maybe the way it's supposed to end is that I never do end the story and he rides off in the sunset.
Dude, if it was a movie and you shot it, people would be bummed at the end of the movie.
People,
I told you, it should be like the movie The Golden Seal.
Yeah, you did.
Did I tell you this?
You did.
We're in the end,
and then you got
you
mad.
Get a chance, and he comes out, you guys lock eyes, and you can't do it. You just drop your gun or drop your bow and start to weep. And the buck, and it starts foggy and it's snowing, and the buck like looks at you and you guys, and he walks off. That's a movie.
That is a movie.
But in the end, the buck walks up and you kill him. Dude, no one's going to like that movie.
People like conclusions, Steve. They like things tied up in a nice bow.
It needs to be like the end of The Deer Hunter.
Well, you got
did
mad.
Did I mention that too?
Yeah, and then you got mad because I hadn't seen it.
Have you seen it yet?
No.
You haven't seen The Deer Hunter?
Still haven't seen The Deer Hunter.
Oh,
but I did
Mark
see
Boardman?
I saw it pop up somewhere. I was like, I should watch that.
You haven't seen The Deer Hunter?
My bad on that one.
Please, anyone?
Right here.
Oh, yeah.
Western Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, you've seen it. It's Red Stags.
Yeah, there's so much about that movie.
It's a war movie, right?
It's about,
the right one?
So okay, it's some guys from Pennsylvania, coal country.
Yeah, and then that
steel country.
The Highland Scottish stag runs across in the myth.
It's a real problem in movies. When you get to knowing too much about wildlife, movies really start to let you down.
The worst movie is The Reverend.
Yeah, dude.
Velvet bulls running across
in
the river.
In a flooded burn.
Yeah,
dude, it was like that. The Deer Hunter, where it winds up, it's like we're in Pennsylvania steel country, but all of a sudden it's a stag.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Then, they leave at night and they show up in the morning. And then,
Last of the Mohicans, it's a red deer.
Yeah.
They just get you every time, man.
I thought about just offering my services to movies. I've
wildlife consultant.
Just be a consultant. Anything that has to do with hunting, it'd be a great job.
Oh, you know.
Just for my, I'll do it for free, just for my own viewing pleasure.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Remy, I'll tell you right now that I have done some of that, and they do not care.
They don't listen.
They do not care.
Early on in my TV career.
They're like, yeah, I get it, but we're not making reality.
We're not marketing this to hunters.
Early on in my TV career, I was trying to explain to a producer about the whole problem of not knowing what's going to happen next. And at one point, he grew frustrated, and he said, well, that's what animal wranglers are for. So
I'm gonna throw out my defense for not seeing that movie, though, because I do recall now thinking about it back in the day when video stores were like a big thing, you know, and going to get a video with your parents.
And you're always looking behind the curtain in the back corner.
Little Marky,
That's a different story.
Just looking for the bathroom.
But I remember begging. Like, I'd pass that one. It'd be on the shelf. And I'd like, that's the one I want to see. The Deer Hunter. I know I'm going to love that movie. Just, you know, going off the title.
It's deeply disturbing.
And then my parents would be like, I don't think that's a movie for you. And then I never caught back up with it. I never revealed that secret, but... Yeah,
it's stunning. I mean, it's a masterpiece.
I'm gonna check it out,
guys. Guys from the, you know, it's guys from Pennsylvania. They go off to fight in Vietnam. It's Christopher Walken, Robert De Niro. One of them goes into the Green Berets. They meet up in a... Then the whole Russian roulette. It's just like, it's horrible.
It is.
It's horrible. But there's some... There's a reckoning, like what Mark will eventually have with Holyfield. There's a reckoning in the end where the deer hunter finds his deer and cannot do it.
I'm gonna check it out.
On a related note, Mark, what's rolling with you guys, like at Vortex? Man, you got a whole big brand new building.
Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest deal. I mean, that's been definitely a long process. And yeah, kudos to everybody that worked on that project. So yeah, we recently got moved in, got settled.
So now it's not Middleton, Wisconsin.
Not Middleton. Yep. So we're close, fairly close. I mean, not too far away, in an adjacent community called Barneveld. And it's a really cool town, smaller town, a little bit more rural. So
not as many sandwich options.
Not as many sandwich options, but it's good, man. I think it's forcing me to eat healthier because you bring a good lunch every day. So
when we were hanging out there though,
uh-huh.
And we went to where you guys were manufacturing,
uh-huh.
What's the line of scopes that you manufacture, that you were manufacturing, the one we went to look?
So right now it's the Razor HD AMG.
What happened to all that stuff? That stuff moves?
Yeah, I moved, which is a big process in of itself. Just, I mean, you hire a company to like take that on. And I mean, that's what they specialize in is moving equipment like that. And I wasn't super close to that process, but I know it was a process.
Did they give you a humongous office? A giant corner office?
I probably have the sweetest cube in the world.
You got a cubicle?
Yeah.
Did you look out your window recently and tell me you saw some birds, or is that someone different? That was you?
I mean, so I'm on the second floor, and actually the whole building, I mean, when you guys come by, I mean, you'll see it. I mean, it really is an engineering masterpiece, but, I mean, good windows, good light. Yeah. We look out, on the the front of the building, or where you would enter the building, backs up to Nature Conservancy.
Do you feel that it'd be unethical if you shot one of those turkeys out of your second story office building? I do.
Out of the second story office building, yeah. I'm probably not going to take that shot. But I've been thinking about that though lately, because I mean, we've been seeing them. They've got some regulars that come by, and you get to know them. Not get to know them, but I mean, you see them regularly. And I'm like, man, I just don't think. And again, it goes into those like ethics, not ethics, but just like those gray areas of, if I was just to be turkey hunting in general, and I came upon a turkey, I'd probably shoot that turkey.
Well, I don't know, because that's the thing. Are you raising your hand, Remy?
I have to say.
Oh, this is like grade school. Remy? Like grade school.
There's so many people in here. It's like you'd be talking over 13 people. No one knows what's going on. Okay, this is what I don't get, though. Your thing with the trout on their spawning beds. Why can't you shoot a turkey in a tree?
It's because it's wrong.
I would. That's how. If it's legal, I would shoot every turkey in a tree.
Different.
Here's
turkeys
how you turkey hunt. Forget the calls. You sneak up to the bottom of the tree in the dark. As soon as shooting hour starts, you have a little beeper on your watch. It goes dee dee. You yell pull, and when that turkey flies out, you shoot some double up buck shot.
As a young man, I attempted something like that, and it did not work.
My question is are those turkeys spawning?
They are spawning. Why can't you shoot a turkey?
Turkeys
in the
are
roost?
Different. Ew. Turkey's different.
I disagree.
Turkeys are majestic, noble. No, this is where the whole thing falls apart. Here's where the whole thing falls apart, because I do believe that there is a right and a wrong way to get a turkey.
See, I just can't go. I just cannot. I will never in my life be talked into that.
I used to be a bushwhacker. I used to bushwhack them. And now I'm like...
A purist.
Saul, is it Paul? Who's up on their Bible learning? Who gets blinded on the way to Damascus? Saul or Paul? If not one of you guys knows this.
It's
really?
Saul.
Gets blinded on the way. Yeah. So I had my Damascus moment where I stopped bushwhacking turkeys.
See, everyone that goes, oh, turkey hunting's so hard, I'm like, hand me the shotgun. I'll show you how hard it is.
Listen, yeah, you're dealing with a different grade turkey.
Okay.
Jumping ducks versus decoying ducks, right?
Yeah, but I like the jump ducks.
I like the jump ducks.
But it's not as cool as decoying them.
It's just, and there's so much more stuff and So much more effort to decoying.
But you would never shoot a duck on the water. Or would
he's
you?
Like, not true. Not true. I have been in situations where, and there's a very good argument to be made for it, where I've been with people who said, listen, I put a lot of time and effort into selecting my spot and camouflaging myself and putting out my decoys and calling, and I'm hunting a high pressure area, right? If I can do everything so right and trick the bird so much, it's supposed to be like, oh, I only kind of tricked him where he passed over and then I shot him. But I went through all the work to fully trick him to the point where he landed in my spread. And it's like, oh, you're too good. You tricked him too much. You've now forfeited your right to shoot the duck. But so some guys will be like, well, I'm going to now jump it up.
Right.
So now you're like, if you put yourself in the duck's position, okay, where I say to you, Brody, I'm going to kill you. Now, I could just shoot you in the head right now, or I'm going to shoot you in the leg and then run around and chase you and beat you over the head with a gun. What are you going to pick?
I'll take the quick one.
Okay. But that's a perspective.
Shooting them on the water, I think, is less effective. I've done it plenty of times.
You know why? No, you can't break their wings.
They dive. Exactly. They dive. It's almost more you jump them up so you know you'll kill them.
Because then you he's – yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've seen some, you know, not that I don't want to say I was on the trigger, but I have seen some real, I have seen some on the water gimmies where everybody's kind of like, how in the world did that not work? Right.
Yeah. You almost have to aim below them.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I want to get back to Mark for a minute though. Lay out for like what's going on with new products and whatnot with you guys.
So yeah, man.
Earlier I was talking about getting a little chub about turkeys. Is there anything I should be getting excited about?
Man, we got some new binos that are super sweet. That'd be good for turkey hunting.
Like, how does it fit? Like, what is what you got coming out? How does it fit in?
I mean, they're new. So we just, like 3 weeks ago, we released our new, I guess, our new generation of the Viper HD binos. So if anybody's familiar with, like, the original Viper HD series, this is kind of a next evolution of those. And, I mean, I guess for me, how it works in a turkey hunting is you should always have a set of binoculars, whatever you're hunting.
I had to get, you know what? The other day, my buddy Tommy Edson was like, do you bring binoculars turkey hunting? I'm like, absolutely.
Yeah, I bring.
Because I like to look at stuff.
Yeah, bring binoculars everything hunting.
Yeah.
I'd be annoyed. I mean, and I have forgot my binoculars before, you know, getting out of the house early in the morning, and it's like forgetting your cell phone. It's like it's the cell phone of hunting equipment. Even though I guess cell phones are kind of part of our hunting equipment now.
But you know what I'm saying, you're always checking your pocket.
Yeah.
I bring them with.
Yeah. You have it. Yeah. Use it. Keep it. Keep it all the time. So they're that. I mean, that's optically, they're a step up. Form factor is awesome. They're a little bit more compact. So yeah,
what are they like when it comes to, are they more, they're less money than the razors?
Yeah. So they'd be kind of like a tier below the razor. But I mean, they're solid bino.
They look good.
Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's the bino that I would suggest even before and now. Like a person who has a need for kind of – who uses their optics in a manner where they kind of have that need for top-tier optical performance but maybe don't have the budget to take on, you know, a top-tier bino like the Razor HD, you know, you can fall back into that Viper HD and you're still getting a very, very good optic for your dollar, yeah.
How do you guys – when you're picturing all that, man – like with the do people call up and like express bafflement about why binoculars and stuff are so expensive, or is it just kind of like people just accept now that it's like a thing that costs money? It was difficult. Like I always talk about in one of our guidebooks, I wrote about guys that roll up in $50,000 pickups with $20 binoculars. I'm like, you got it all wrong, bro. You know.
I mean, I think that still happens, you know, and I think, and we've talked about this before, but I mean, I think it takes somebody having that optics epiphany, you know, when they really see what it's about, you know, and maybe they use their buddies, you know, really good binos or something like that. And then, you know, they're like, oh man, I need to get a set of those.
I can tell you my epiphany. Do you know my epiphany?
I think we talked about it before, but yeah, what was it?
We're hunting on the years ago, first time I ever went out there, we're hunting on the north slope of the Brooks Range, and there's a grizzly coming up the other side of the river from our camp. And I'm looking at it through my binos. And that looked through my buddy's binos. And he had just spent a season packing moose on the Alaska Peninsula. And the guy gave him a set of souped up binos. And what I'm looking at him is just like this amorphous brown blob walking up the other riverbank. And I look through his and I can see that that there's like the wind's blowing and it's forming these little cowlicks in the bear's hair. And I'm watching this like cowlick kind of move around on its rump with the breeze blowing on it. And I'm like, I can tell you what I'm going to be saving up some money for.
Yeah.
It's like actual binos.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if a,
and since then, now I just like, I'm just addicted to looking through them.
Well, and I think that you, when you get used to having something like that in the woods, like if you haven't been using binos, if you haven't been carrying them, which I think I'd say by and large, like a lot of people do now. Right. But I think maybe it's less common, you know, even, you know, 15, 20 years ago, whatever. I'm throwing a very non-concrete timeline on that. But once you do, I think you realize like what you've been missing and you just, yeah, you can't get enough. And then you realize how important they are and what you can do with them. Like you can look at stuff, you know, and whether you're tree stand hunting in Wisconsin or, you know, coos deer hunting in Arizona, man. I mean, it's an important piece to have for sure.
You hang out with Bubbly Doug Dern.
Mm-hmm.
I was hunting with Doug one time. And we walked up in what he calls the big woods up by the wet spot, which are the two great names for bars. And we get by the wet spot and I just like take my binos and scan through the big woods and glass up the tippy tippy top of a turkey fan. Never in a million years would we'd have walked in and spooked it. Glassed up that tippy top of a turkey fan and we sat down and killed that bird. Maybe an hour later.
Yeah.
Never would have found that turkey.
No, I mean, you wouldn't have killed that bird without those binos.
No, I was kind of like, when I saw it, I was like shocked by what I was looking at. Yeah. I think it's like a super important thing.
And that's just, you know, a good example of one tactic, right? You know, when you're creeping into that field, you know, stay back, glass it, you know, before you expose yourself and blow the whole thing out, you know, and you guys obviously saw something, got an opportunity and capitalized on it.
Remy, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just adjusting myself.
Okay, I got...
sorry.
Another thing, like, speaking of how I was talking about that there should be a bar called the Wet Spot, which we discussed before, a guy wrote in to say, like, if there was a bar called the Bearded Hen, would you go into it? And he also was wondering, and this is a good question, would most states you could kill... Like, most states a legal bird is a bearded bird. 1 in 100 hens is bearded. Roughly. I think it's like it depends on the areas and whatnot. Would you shoot a bearded hen?
Ask Mark, me that question.
Would you shoot a bearded hen?
I've got one mounted on my wall.
You shot a bearded
hen? Yeah, shot a bearded hen.
And you knew you were shooting a bearded hen?
That's a good question. It was fall. I don't know. Yeah, it's just like beard, boom.
Gotcha.
Exact same. Minus the mounting.
You shot a bearded hen.
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Well, now that these guys have broke the ice, and I know it's a safe space.
My name's Mike Boardman.
but I rolled a bearded hen in
the spring.
In the spring, but I called this bird in, and you know, and it's kind of, you know, doing this turkey stuff, and little beard poked out. And I'm like, oh, cool. And
so you're like, it's a female. But it's got a beard, so it's legal.
You know, I mean, at the time, it was happening pretty quick, but I saw that beard, and I let it rip. And I don't know, I can't say that I necessarily... I mean, in the fall, I think it's a little bit different because they're... You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, that's what happened.
See, I think it's wrong.
I identified...
I want to clarify, I have never shot a turkey out of a roost, but I also don't think it's wrong, just in case I'm backpedaling. But I have no... You can kill... A turkey with a tack hammer in your backyard. It's a barn animal, man. You can do it any way you want. No rules with turkeys.
I generally fall under a state's, whatever the state defines as the regulations.
Yeah, you know what Aldo Leopold said about that?
No.
Ethics is doing the right thing
when nobody's
looking.
When
no one is watching, even when doing the wrong thing is legal.
Oh, my God.
I'm not saying it's wrong. It's not wrong, but if I was hunting and I was hunting spring turkeys, and a hen came in with a beard on it, I would not be able to. This is coming from the man who would pitchfork browns out of a drainage ditch. I would not be able to harm that female turkey. I don't believe. Last day of a long hunt, and there's a bearded hen. I don't know. Would you go into a bar named the bearded hen.
With a level of uncertainty, yes.
Would you bring your wife into a bar called the bearded hen?
Absolutely not.
That's the only way I would go in.
All right. We've got a lot of concluding thoughts. Lots of concluding thoughts to go through. We'll start with Brody.
Oh, man. I'm just excited. Turkey season's I'm not there for the opener, but Colorado opened today, so I'm stoked to get back and go chase some turkeys and shoot them out of trees with a nail gun.
That's how you do it this year?
What's that?
What is your actual turkey hunt plan?
Well, I got two tags. I drew a tag and I got an over the counter tag. So I'll hunt the draw tag first and then let all the guys clear out of the over the counter areas.
And then get after.
Get after a couple weeks later, yeah.
My brother got both his turkeys today, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, just watch and say, yeah, he just did a trip and got two turkeys.
So he doesn't like stretching the hunt out.
No. You know, in some places you can't do that.
On the same day. You know what I saw the other day? In Arkansas, you're not allowed to shoot jakes.
What?
In spring season.
What?
Yeah.
That's wrong.
It says God. Yeah.
That's immoral to make a
Talk
rule.
Talk about bearded hens. You can't shoot a jake.
Well, you know, we're going to Missouri tomorrow, and I've been trying to weigh out in my head. I'm going to hold out for a long beard, but at what point do I, as my brother says, put the jake brakes on one?
Well, that's what's nice about having two tags. You can, you know, you can focus on the big boy and take a jake home.
They banned shooting jakes in the spring?
I just stumbled across it, you know, looking at the on Arkansas website, and they'd posted their regs and no jakes.
For you listeners, a jake is a 1-year-old turkey, and he doesn't have spurs yet. He's just got little round nubs, and his beard is like an inch or two long.
And I'd have a few more unpunched turkey tags if it was illegal to kill jakes.
Yeah.
I would never shoot a jake. The audacity. That's where I draw the line.
In the roost with his nail gun. But he's like, yeah, I can only go so low here.
A bearded hen, that's one thing. That's just weird. But a jake, you know, he hasn't even had a chance to breed yet.
No, they don't.
You monsters.
His fan, his fan's not totally tricked out.
No.
He can't do a real rip and gobble. Was that your concluder, Brody?
Yeah.
Mark Kenyon? Been in the hot seat?
Yeah. You know, this is my first BHA rendezvous I've been at. We haven't really talked about like where we're at here and what's going on, but I think my concluding thought is just what an awesome group of people that's here at this event. I mean, the energy has been really impressive. The relative youth has been surprising and impressive. Maybe not surprising, but I think compared to other events you go to within the hunting and fishing world, it doesn't look like this. So that was encouraging to see. And stoked about it. You get a lot of excitement in a group like this for the future of what we're doing here in the hunting and fishing and conservation world. And the future's bright when you look at this group.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning to see pictures of the group, and the age demographic defies the norm. I remember not too long ago I read that in Michigan, the average age of a person who buys a trapping license goes up exactly one every year. Which is
old Ted.
Still at it.
It was harrowing. Remy, can we talk about how you're off the market?
Oh, yeah.
So all those ladies.
Locked down.
What's that ring made out of?
I don't know if I could. Woolly mammoth ivory.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, it's not legal woolly mammoth ivory.
Yeah. I like that.
Is there now there's like a big thing they want to ban mammoth ivory because it's becoming like replacing elephant ivory apparently.
Oh, you know, a lot of it depends on where it was found.
Yeah.
You know, private land, public land. If it's found on private land, it's like,
exactly.
Have at it.
Yeah.
Because, there's a lot of, you know, Brody, were you just sending me that article? I think you did. You know, are you familiar with the Lacey? I guess you're with the Lacey Act.
Oh, yeah.
So for a listener who isn't, and I, you're excused if you don't know the Lacey Act. The Lacey Act is one of the things that allowed us to, you know, back in the early 1900s, the Lacey Act is one of the things that allowed us to start putting an end to market hunting, which was decimating wildlife populations. It makes it a federal offense to move illegally obtained wildlife across state lines. So if states might have lax rules governing wildlife, but the Lacey Act allows you to make federal crimes out of moving things around. And someone was just showing me an article where, and this is kind of perplexing, they're using the Lacey Act to go after people smuggling dinosaur bones. So here you're taking an animal from 65 million years ago who has a fossilized bone and using a contemporary wildlife trafficking law to it's a novel approach, man. I don't know how well it will hold up in court.
It's not recognized as wildlife.
Yep.
When I called Alberta First Fish and Game, when I found that buffalo skull, they...
It was only a couple hundred years old.
Yep. He said, great. Buffalo is not a recognized game species.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Do whatever you want with it.
You find some mineralized, like when you find a dinosaur fossil,
it's right? rock.
It's right. Yeah, it's just rock. A weird deal, man. Yeah. It's a weird deal.
That is
but
weird.
What they're looking for there is where it was applicable is there's a lot of people, like right now, everybody goes to Mongolia for dinosaur fossils. It's like the new, it'd be like, you know, it'd be like New Mexico in the 1930s, right? It's just like, it's not picked over yet. People used to just see it and disregard it the same way, you know, people used to not pick up Indian arrowheads, and all of a sudden you get enough time and separating the two events and it starts to become something noteworthy. So there's people like looting all these, and there's not much enforcement in Mongolia. So there's people looting all these dinosaur fossils out of Mongolia and bringing them into the U.S. and they're using the Lacey Act to go after people with it, which I thought was an interesting approach. But Remy, your concluder, you're married. Does it feel different?
Yeah, feels good. I think it should feel different a little bit, you know. Yeah. I like it. I'm excited about it. It's a great wedding, and it was a lot of fun. Also, one of my final thoughts, everyone will think that I hate on turkeys. Mostly it's just for fun.
It's fun to hate trout.
It's like one of those things. It's like I can pick the turkey guy that's a fanatic about turkey and just go after him only because I think I've got that turkey hunter distaste from guiding in Montana or guiding elk hunters so much. And these guys coming in going, oh yeah, elk hunt. No, I've got it. It's just like turkey hunting. I'm like, nah, sorry. I've been turkey hunting. It's nothing like elk hunting.
Calling the two they have a lot of similarities.
Oh, sheep hunting. It's a lot like turkey hunting.
I think what I think of turkey hunting as being like a little mini elk hunt because it's like it does have this, right? That there's a male. And he has this audacious noise he makes. And then there's a female, and she has sort of a more tempered, kind of calm version that she makes. And you're using the one to bring in the other. And you sit up on a high spot, and you're praying to hear a gobble, just like you're praying to hear a bugle.
If I was... but it's like saying elk hunting is a lot like... Well, then turkey hunting is a lot like pigeon hunting. You're like...
I would never say it.
Right.
I think Yanni does say it.
The turkey hunts like,
but I see where they're coming from.
I get it, but it's also in my mind two completely different things. Yeah. And if anybody that has said that to me while I've been guiding them learned within a few minutes that it was not the same.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, let's go up this mountain over here.
A blanket statement of saying the hunting of the two is similar, I would say that that's pretty false for obvious reasons to anybody. But I think when you start talking about interacting and calling animals, there aren't any other animals that I've hunted anywhere where you call and interact with like that. And I've done a little bit of duck hunting now.
But that's not gender specific.
What?
Calling ducks isn't the same thing, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's the same thing at all. You know, even though a lot of people get into that interaction, but it's still not like you're not playing the hen or the cow and trying to call in a bull, or you could play the gobbler or another bull and call in a bull.
Yeah, ducks don't come in with your lipstick out.
Use terrain similarly to, you know, to bring the animal over a roll to come see, you know, you making that call. I mean, you do those same two exact tactics.
I'm feeling it. From now on, Remy, this fall, he's going to be like, you know what? It's a lot like turkey hunting.
It's a lot like turkey hunting.
I used to disagree, but now I agree. Cal?
I don't know. I mean, all good things. That fish deal, man, we've been over that a million times in similar circles on fish off their reds. And yeah, it's a real interesting one.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah,
kinda,
please do.
I didn't have my headset on earlier, or I didn't have a headset, but it's kind of like the stocked pond. You can make an analogy with the stocked pond, right?
Yeah.
Like fishing the reds, all of us probably that would ethically like kind of not do it now for trout, or just whether it's ethics or you're just kind of like, whatever, it's too easy, it's fishing a bucket. The first time you went and did it, you were probably like, holy shit, this is fun, you know? Like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
And then the second or third time, it's kind of like going back to this stocked trout pond the second or third time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, all right.
See, that's the thing. That's why I feel a little bit of guilt, is because I remember hearing about and really like exploring and trying to find the mythical brown trout spawn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this is before it was a bad thing. I remember people like, I remember reading in like guidebooks, you know, good areas to go look for spawning browns.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you also probably could find guidebooks that told you how to, you know, blow up Canada geese off dams by packing buckshot around dynamite sticks too. You know what I mean?
Build yourself a cannon. What you're going to need.
So that's your concluding thought? Is you just wanted to touch back on something earlier?
Oh, I guess I'll just say thanks. Love these discussions. That's good. And yeah, I guess also absolutely blown away at how much this BHA rendezvous has grown. It's crazy. We had those seminars this morning.
Nuts.
And asked, I got to introduce Remy for his Q&A and be the moderator for it. But asked out of the gate, how many people is this your first rendezvous? And I mean, it had to have been over 50% of that room.
I thought it was even more, like 80%+. There's a lot of people in there. Surprised me.
Seats 400. So, and that had to be over three, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It
was crazy. The first one I went to was probably 6 or 7 years ago, and it was at the fairground in Missoula. And I gave a talk to like the dinner thing. And, most maybe 150 people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's growing like crazy. And I think, Mark, you're spot on, man. I mean, the youth is so encouraging to see. It's the youngest kind of rod and gun anything I've been around. So pretty neat to see. Hopefully making some impacts, I think, as far as there's lots of talk today. And the last couple of days really about, you know, how we move the needle as far as new hunter recruitment and hunter retainment. And just like Remy said many times this morning, it's like we got to – every single person is an ambassador for what we love to do, and we got to do a hell of a lot better job putting a better face on it. So, yeah, it's been a cool cool couple of days so far.
Mr. Phelps?
Yeah, so this is my first BHA rendezvous. It's been awesome. You know, one thing that's kind of opened my eyes is I'm fairly conservative. I come from a logging town, and then you kind of show up with people that maybe you don't see eye to eye with, but we're all here for the one thing that we love.
So and they're like, less taxes. You're like, more taxes.
And I'm going to make a funny joke, you know, like the shiny puffy coats. I kind of make a joke. Like at home, I'm the guy in a fleece because that's old school. But yeah, I've never been around so many hunters in a shiny puffy coat before. But it's cool because you can take that. And we're all here for the same reason. We all love to recreate on public land. We all love to hunt and fish on it. And for all of us to come together as a group of people with the one passion and be laser focused on public lands is awesome. Yeah. And I do want to.
Hey, do you feel that this? Can you check this out?
No, it's got a over? First. It's got a first light. You're
can
good.
You check it out?
That like
part of my jacket's a little shiny.
No, you're good.
I just wanted us to be fighting.
No, I'm just kidding. Remy's a jerk for shooting turkeys out of a tree.
You agree with that? How about bearded hens?
So there's two sides. Like then you guys didn't even really get into like the genetic mutation side of it. Like maybe we should get those things out of here.
Are they bad?
I don't know if it's bad. I've just heard that side of the story. Like, it is a genetic mutation, and we should shoot those things.
But I would say that if without genetic mutations, I feel like life would have ended a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying. I wouldn't specifically target one. If one came walking through the setup and I knew it was a bearded hen, I'll probably let it go. But it's one of those things where, you know, I'm not going to pass my own belief onto somebody. You know, if you want to shoot it, it's within the state laws. And that's kind of gets back to the fishing thing. You know, where Cal doesn't want to fish over the reds, but then maybe my kid does, cause that's a different experience. And so I don't necessarily say we want to put laws that, you know, cover that or blanket it for everybody. But then, you know, he's out there for the sport and the, you know, the uncertainty of hooking up one, where like me taking my kid, maybe I don't want to do that, but I want to have the ability to take my kid and hook up to that fish. And so I think there's a, and you know, you got to look at it through that scope of who the person is and, you know, take it for what it is.
When you were talking earlier about, like political spectrums, do you feel that, do you feel that people, right, who lean politically right and people who lean politically left, do you see like in your community that people coalesce around the idea of supporting public lands, or in particular like supporting federal land management agencies and sort of assisting them and you know, giving them verbal support and helping them, you know, make decisions that allow access, but you know, do you feel that that people are coming around this idea in your community, or do you feel that it's a divisive issue in your community?
I live in the dead center of Weyerhaeuser country, you know, the biggest land manager in the state of Washington. And so there's a very select few of us that have to travel 2 hours to the east to recreate on, you know, some federal lands. We have some state owned lands and stuff, but so I would, around home, it's more of interest on like how Weyerhaeuser's managing, not necessarily on the public.
Because you guys
land.
Are recreating on publicly accessible land that's privately owned.
Well, now as long as you pay $350, you get a key. So
yeah, I bought a $100 pass for walking.
Yeah. So you can do that. Yeah. I mean, everybody finds it important, you know, anything that you know, affects them and their recreation, then people are passionate about.
Yeah.
So we don't get a big push in my area for public lands, besides a few of us that you know, routinely drive 2 hours east to recreate.
I see what you're saying. I got you. So when you're hunting local, you're hunting
Weyerhaeuser or
privately owned
industrial
that allows public, which and that's like that too is a significant thing. Yep. And I think that's people look at the public lands debate and groups like BHA that really support public lands, and I think other people kind of have this question, like our friend Doug, who's very involved in private land conservation, and he'll kind of feel like, he doesn't really say this, but I think that sometimes he feels like, well, why all of a sudden all this attention? Like, most land in the country, especially in the East, most land is private land. If we're going to get serious about conservation, we have to pay a lot of attention to private land conservation. That's where that's where some of the most important conservation work. But I would say to him, and I do say to him, but there's not an emptiness there. I think that we have stuff in place to try to do that. Like, farm bills, CRP programs. I mean, there's a lot more dollars per acre that go into private land conservation issues. But I think he kind of feels that there's a sort of lack of sexiness around all that, just like the work of doing good wildlife work on private land.
Yeah.
And I think like there's this third area too, which is these sort of almost like wilderness type places, these big tree farms, which are the size of, they own land the size of national forests, that are, you know, privately held. Yeah. And there's a conservation question to have there too. And also like giving them the credit of allowing a public access program. They're not making tons of money on public access.
Yeah, no. And I think it comes back, and maybe I'm a little off here, but it comes back to the reason we're so passionate about public lands is all eight of us in this room can end up at some wilderness in Colorado hunting. And so we are all concerned about the conservation on that piece of public land. We're a private land in Iowa, I have this much interest in it because I'm never going to get a hunt there, even though I do care about the species. So I think it comes back to a little bit of that selfish nature that all of us in this room can not take advantage, but we have the ability to recreate on some of this public land that potentially holds the animals we want to go pursue, where that private land back east, it just doesn't hold anything for us, even though we all do care about, you know, the whitetail and, you know, the stuff that is back there that I may not, you know, get to hunt. Private property ever.
You know, I keep talking about Doug, but he's got a funny story. I kind of hesitate to tell this. I don't want to get Doug in trouble. Well, I'll tell it. So Doug's in a bar, and a guy, like a local guy in the bar, is like, oh, yeah, if you want to hunt Doug's place, you got to be like a celebrity, you know. Doug won't let anybody hunt his place. And Doug says, half the bar picks up and goes, well, I was just hunting Doug's place. Some guy goes, maybe you don't hunt Doug's place because you're an asshole. So there is, yeah, I think there is that, like, sure, you're doing great work, but how's it benefit me? Yeah, and that's a funny thing to bring up, that there is some sort of like a little bit of a selfish nature about public land because you're looking out for your own best interest. But I remember saying it before that if someone came to me, like with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, if I had to make a deal, we were talking about this with John Gierick. I was like, if I had to make a deal with the devil, and they said, okay, here's the story, Sonny. You're never allowed to step foot back here. In exchange for that, we'll never drill it, but you'll never see it again. Or you can come here all you want. I would be like, well, I'll take the I don't step foot on it ever again deal. Like, let's go with that one. So I think that it's not always, I think that you wind up having this idea of that you do have a sense of ownership over it, and whether you're going to use it or not, it feels the same way. That's why I think a thing that needs to happen in the conservation world is the sense of, and it happens in other factions, other cultural factions, where an attack on one is an attack on all. But I think that a lot of times outdoorsmen tend to be very sort of myopic and kind of provincial in their view of that they're really worried about their corner of the world. And it's like harder to picture. Like for me, I've never hunted in Nebraska. So maybe a conservation issue in Nebraska doesn't feel as immediate to me, right? But to try to foster this conservation sense where people do, they're like, uh-oh, there's trouble brewing in Nebraska. I don't go there. Probably never will go there. Don't have any buddies there. But I'm going to come in their defense and help them out on this wildlife issue just because I'm viewing it like an attack on one is attack on all. But I think it's
super frustrating. Can't only be a direct threat. It has to be an immediate direct threat for the hunting community to get really fired up from what I've seen.
Yeah.
It's got to be, oh, right now?
This week?
Let me get my boots on.
Mark Borman, concluders?
I got a couple. One, my level of guilt for shooting this bearded hen is off the charts right now, but I put some thought into it because I was thinking of the
scenario.
You
got to feeling guilty about the bearded hen?
Well, yeah, because I felt bad. I'll say this. I kind of felt bad at the moment too, but I put some thought into why those rules are in place, and I think it applies to the scenario in which this incident happened where I called this bird in. I identified with absolute certainty that it had a beard.
Yeah.
And I made the decision to pull the trigger based on that. And then upon further discovery, was like, oh, well, that's a unique thing.
Yeah, but you got to have some marker. Like, you can't say male or female because you're going to invite, because people are going to be like, well, what's the best way to indicate male or femaleness? And someone might very reasonably say a beard.
Right.
Because you're not going to tell him, look at the spurs, because it's hard to see spurs.
Yep.
Like, it's down on its foot, and he's walking through tall grass. So you can't have that. You can't say, like, oh, you got to wait till he fans out and struts and displays, because a lot of times they don't do that.
Yeah.
Or he'll gobble. Well, maybe he comes in quiet. So at some point, and then there's things with the head, like a seasoned turkey hunter
mm-hmm.
will look at a head, especially in the spring, and know what they're looking at, but not always. So
like,
the same way deer, like it doesn't say, well, some states do will say like a buck or male, but oftentimes it's an antlered deer because you got to go like, what is the identifying feature that we're all going to agree upon? So the fact that 1 in 100 turkeys is masquerading around with the beard, I don't think it's like it's a legitimate mistake to make.
Right.
You're sitting there in the woods and here comes a turkey and all of a sudden there's that beard. It's like game on, most people.
Well, yeah, and that's why I'm almost wondering, and I don't know, right? But like you said, it's an identifying feature, so that rule's put in place. So if something like that does happen, like that person didn't break the law,
yeah.
Right? Because the intent was not there. Like my guess would be that if there was no such thing as a bearded hen, they'd be like, yeah, you can only shoot gobblers in the spring.
Yeah, be males.
You know, so anyway, that's my. And then my other concluder.
So it's tearing you up. Have you pitchforked Brown off his spawning bed lately?
Regularly. Yeah. My other concluder is, yeah, I mean, I'll just echo Mark and Cal's thoughts on the BHA rendezvous. Cool event. Awesome. Like-minded people. I think there's a unique electricity and a unique energy and a strong momentum of groups that maybe that hunt and fish, but maybe cross a few other boundaries. And I think that momentum is going to hopefully, you know, carry through where people, whether you do hunt and fish or, you know, enjoy public lands for other recreational purposes, you know, we can all agree on the same thing that about how important they are.
Well said. I got two concluders. No, kind of one. Who was here when we were talking about all the different ways they artificially inseminate and extract semen from dogs and whatnot? You were here.
I was. We were talking.
No one else was here.
With Ronnie.
Ronnie and Doug.
Yeah.
A guy that listened to that and wrote in how he, when he was in doing animal and physiology studying in a veterinary school, he was talking about their method of horse semen collection. Is they'd have this, he calls it a large wooden contraption that the stallion would do his business to. And after it did its business, you would use they demonstrated how to use it like a little straw. And you just use a little vacuum created with your own mouth to kind of fill that straw with the semen after he deposited it on this.
And
whatever.
Then you just pack the straw away for later use.
And you say you only oversuck once, man. You don't make that mistake again. But we had gotten a lot. I'm not going to go through them all. We had a lot of feedback from people about how to extract semen from various creatures that I'll not get into right now. But I wanted to share that one quickly. And the other thing I wanted to say is and this is from the bottom of my heart. Like, dude, it is so nice to have people like all of you guys to talk to. Like, honestly, man. Yeah. Any sense of loneliness one feels in the world, like find a group of guys like you that you can like talk about this shit and they understand what you're talking about. It makes me feel very happy and alive. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Very much. Care.